On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats to answer these questions. With Ja Morant's drop in performance, could we see a major shakeup in Memphis? Can Ja evolve into a more well-rounded player, or are his limitations a sign of things to come? And lastly, what to expect when Steph takes on LeBron and Luka in LA? All that and more coming up right after this. Welcome, welcome, welcome to The Big Number. I'm Tom Haberstroh, and we do this show every Thursday at Yahoo Sports with my man, Dan Devine. Dan, how are you?
I'm doing well. I got like the slick back going right now. I'm feeling like very, very aerodynamic. I'm feeling I'm going to be able to move quickly and agilely, maybe not so agile, through this podcast. Tom, I'm ready to put up some numbers. Hit me with it. What are we talking about today?
All right, this week's big number is 22.7. That is Ja Morant's scoring average this season, which marks the third straight consecutive year that he's seen his scoring average drop from 27.4 in his age 22 season down to 26.4 26.2 in the next season, and then 25.1, and then down all the way to 22.7 this year. Big picture, this is not a great direction you want to be in.
I don't know a ton about math, but going down, not so good.
Not good. And that was kind of unthinkable considering of where his trajectory was going before. At age 22, averaging 27 points, most improved player of the year, second team all NBA, seventh in the MVP vote, and he seemed to be the next face of the NBA, like on the ascension. And ever since, it has not gone well for Ja Morant, and the Memphis Grizzlies recently have made the decision, Zach Kleiman, the GM, to fire the head coach, Taylor Jenkins, 9 games before the playoffs begin. And all of this is swirling. They're in it kind of a little bit of a tailspin record-wise in the last couple months here since the All-Star break. So you have the coaching change 9 games before the postseason. Then you have the scoring average from Ja Morant not having his best season. And then, of course, on Tuesday night, I mean, what do you say? Ja Morant had a gun gesture toward the Golden State Warriors bench late in that fourth quarter against the Golden State Warriors. Buddy Hield was also returning the gesture toward, appears as such, toward Ja Morant. Games in its closing seconds. And here we have another incident where Ja Morant, according to ESPN's Shams Charania and Tim McMahon, are reporting that the NBA is investigating Ja Morant for the gun gesture pointed towards the Golden State Warriors bench, which, by the way, Buddy Hield and Ja Morant got double technicals for. So this is another not great thing for Ja Morant. He coming off the 25-game suspension, which was coming on the heels of an 8-game suspension for gun gestures on social media. This just seems like, Dan, this has been not a great season for the Memphis Grizzlies. And it seemed like a month ago, Dan, this was like a pretty feel-good story with Taylor Jenkins in the running for coach of the year. The Memphis Grizzlies utilizing a new offense predicated on, spacing and relocation by Noah LaRoche. And now Taylor Jenkins is gone. Noah LaRoche is gone. And another assistant coach is gone. And now we have another cloud of controversy around Ja Morant. Dan, my question to you is, a couple weeks ago, Zach Kleiman said at the trade deadline that no, we are not trading Ja Morant, and kind of laughed off the whole idea. To the commercial appeal, he said, "I can't blame other executives for fantasizing about us trading Ja, but it's just that fantasy. We are not trading Ja. Continue to underestimate Ja, this team and this city, and we will let our performance on the floor speak for itself. I'm not going to give this nonsense further oxygen, and look forward to us getting back to basketball." Since then, they've gone 8-14 and fired Taylor Jenkins, and now Ja Morant is back in the spotlight for all the wrong reasons. Dan, do you believe that? Do you believe that it's a fantasy to suggest that Ja Morant would be traded, or do you think they may have reconsidered things given how the coaching change has happened and how this another incident has happened and the season hasn't turned around at all, despite that very strong statement from the GM, Zach Kleiman?
Well, yeah, the first thing it made me think of was, you know, Zach Kleiman basically saying, like, my "we're not trading Ja Morant" t-shirt, even though nobody asked, is answering a lot of questions, raising a lot of questions that I've already answered with my t-shirt. Like, guys, I swear, I promise, we're not doing it. No one was talking about you doing that. What are you talking about? So yeah. it's like the Streisand effect. You've invited more focus on the issue by loudly proclaiming you wouldn't. Luka Doncic got traded to the Lakers in the middle of the night. Everything is possible. Nothing is, we live in the realm of fantasy. Who knows? There's going to be dragons flying around soon. Certainly the way things have gone over the last, 6 weeks, maybe even a couple of months, would suggest that, all is not well in Memphis, before we even get to Ja doing finger guns, which if I can just a public service announcement. As somebody who was old enough to blog about Gilbert Arenas, let me just say to you, if you have gun stuff, don't do gun stuff, like pretend fake gun stuff, not Nerf gun stuff, not no gun stuff, no finger guns, no nothing. You gotta steer clear of that. You gotta Euro step that one and just go to the bench. We have to learn from history lest we be doomed to repeat it.
And Dan, like him, he retweeted, appeared to retweet on his X account, a screen grab of Buddy Hield doing the gun gesture back at Ja Morant with the caption saying tell the whole story. And sure. I'm like, dude, every team is going to try to, get under your skin and try to egg you on to do something stupid. They're going to do that. And they're not going to treat Buddy Hield the same way that they're going to treat Ja Morant. It has never happened that way in the NBA. Prior record does impact the suspension or the punishment. They in the 25 game punishment, handed down by the NBA on Ja Morant, they're citing the previous incidents regarding the gun gestures on social media. So we already know that prior history is going to impact in the same way that guys will be suspended for altercations if they have a history, even though if Rudy Gobert and Draymond Green are getting in an altercation, probably Draymond is going to get more severe punishment because it's Draymond Green and he has a history of this and it might have jeopardize their championship in 2016. But anyway, you are saying if you've done gun stuff before, maybe not do that if you've already been suspended twice for it.
That aside, because I really would love to be able to put that aside. Here's hoping we can put that aside. It's worth noting for context, you mentioned Ja's declining scoring average. He's also playing a lot, he's playing fewer minutes, right? So on a per minute and per possession basis, the scoring has been about level. Hasn't continued to ascend, which is its own problem, but it's still in that ballpark. But the fact, they think that's all sort of part of the ecosystem here. He's playing 30 minutes a game because the Grizzlies are playing a style where it's structurally different and we want all gas, no breaks, maximum intensity, maximum pace. We're going to go 11 deep. We're going to play, it's guys that are for 10 days and 2 ways in reclamation projects alongside our high lottery picks. And we're going to everybody's going to go full bore. And the structure of that offense, and we're going to move away from the steady diet of the heavy high pick and roll that Ja rode to superstardom in favor of more space and drive and cut and a more democratic kind of free flowing offense. All of that lends to a de-emphasis on his individual production, right? So it's not just Ja can get downhill and get to the rim against anybody. Yeah, but if he's got the ball less, if he's playing fewer minutes, if he's getting fewer touches, if his seconds per touch are down, his dribbles per touch are down, his time of possession is down, all of those things, then he's going to put up lower numbers. And even if the overall ecosystem of the offense maybe is healthier, and we could talk about, the half court points per possession is up this year after being bad for most of the Grizzlies history. It was about league average this year, which is a big step up for them. Ja's role in that was smaller and he apparently wasn't a big fan of that. And it was a story on ESPN on Monday that suggested that he was not a huge fan of the offense and that the move toward or away from Taylor Jenkins and to Tuomas Isola, the new assistant coach that was elevated, is aimed at optimizing Ja. We're going to lean a little bit more into what got us to the dance. And I think that you can argue that there's positives and negatives to that. But I think maybe the question, Tom, is what does optimizing for Ja Morant right now get you if you're Memphis? Are we confident that that is the best way forward for them, given how up and down everything has felt over the last couple of years?
Well, Dan, how good is Ja Morant? That's a really open-ended question.
Base level.
Yeah, they're putting all their chips toward Ja Morant with the coaching change and with that statement from Zach Kleiman. But the question is he a good shooter? hasn't produced at that level in 30% from downtown. And that was after like his best shooting season, shooting game of the season, 5 for 8 against Golden State, 36 points. He was coming out with an intent to shoot from deep every time down the floor, it seemed. He got hot and it was good for the first half. And then in the fourth quarter, everything fell apart for Ja with 4 turnovers down the stretch. And a bunch of those turnovers were coming in that pick and roll, that high pick and roll, and going into the teeth of Draymond Green, which is not a good strategy. Like, in general, if you're trying to win a basketball game, going straight into like the gully of Draymond Green is not a great idea. And in some ways, it cost them the game. Obviously, emotions played into that with the Buddy Hield incident. And I do think that with Ja Morant, the question is, can his body hold up for an entire season in doing Ja Morant things around the rim? And if not, he better develop that perimeter game. If he's not a great knockdown shooter from the perimeter and he can't get into the paint and finish at a high level and dunk over everybody, then I don't think he's that guy at age 22. And he's somewhere below that. He's somewhere that at this level, he's going to be fighting for all-star appearances rather than fighting for MVP appearances, which is what I think where his trajectory was seemingly headed before a few years ago when it just started all seeming to fall apart. Now, Ja Morant's still good, but with that decline, I actually digged into the numbers here, Dan. There have been 19 players in NBA history who have averaged 25 or more points at age 22, according to stathead.com. So this is like elite scorers right out of the box. Age 22, 25 plus. Of those 19 players, only 3 of them have seen their scoring average from that like 25 and over range decline in 3 straight years. And it hasn't happened in a half a century. So it's Ja Morant. Wow. It's Walt Bellamy and it's Marquise Johnson. And basically, oof, since like the 3-point line has been added, we haven't seen a score come out this hot and then kind of fall down precipitously since then. He's still a good player. But to me, Memphis really has to look. The next 4 years, they've got about $42 million a year, or 3 years, I should say. 3 years after this one allocated to Ja Morant. And I wouldn't be surprised if he's in a different uniform by the end of that contract. Man. And it wouldn't be surprising if he is traded this summer. But look, man, there are not many great destinations for Ja Morant. Like, if you're not an elite shooter at the point guard position, and his dunk rate has fallen precipitously as well, when you look at where it was 4 years ago, where he had 5.7% of his field goal attempts were dunks. He had 57 dunks. Around 55 dunks for the like 2 years after that. And then this year he has 15 dunks and his dunk rate has been sliced in half. So like, if Ja Morant isn't doing that and he isn't a high level shooter yet, are other teams going to want that guy at the price tag of about $44 million a year? And it's not a long list of teams that might be interested.
Yeah. Just a preview or a little amuse bouche little number. Of the 183 players who've taken at least 200 threes this season, Ja is 176th in accuracy, 30%. So right very near the bottom. He's taken a lot and he ain't making a lot. And that's not a recipe for success or for driving up a market. Yeah, I mean, I kind of went through the just generally looking at the standings and trying to play matchmaker a little bit. And it didn't make a ton. I didn't see a ton of lily pads for him to jump to or places for Memphis to, you know, it made a ton of sense out of the box. Now, with the caveat that like every front office person is a hell of a lot smarter than me. So I'm sure that there is something I'm just not seeing, but like the Spurs and Wembanyama thing, that went away when they got De'Aaron Fox. Orlando, they've already got a half court offense. You know, we don't have enough shooters problem. Your guys up in Portland seem like they're more likely to move away from a guard than add another, you know, high usage one. The Nets, all the rumblings are that they're thinking about somebody a lot taller and maybe Greek with their, you know, assets and free and cap space to spend. And the last time that Brooklyn added a complicated point guard, things didn't work out super hot. So like most of the true tanking teams are probably too far away to really justify $42 million for a superstar guard that plays like 60% of the time. I mean, it leaves you with stuff like, I don't know, a challenge trade of Ja for Trae Young, a challenge trade of Ja for LaMelo Ball. And like, if that's where we're at, then like, what are we doing? So, I mean, I don't know. When I looked at that, I looked at it and said, I don't know that I see an obvious answer on that horizon. Even if Zach Kleiman does say like, yeah, we actually are looking for business. So then it leaves you wondering like, where does any of this go?
Yeah, I know. It might just be Memphis, right? It might just be Memphis. And Zach Kleiman's statement was also like, we can't trade Ja. Like, we're not going to get a good deal for Ja. So we are not trading Ja. And that might be the change, is that like, since that statement.
Whatever you guys say, I'm not doing it. So definitely don't bring me your best offer by end of day tomorrow. Whatever you say.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think, look, Ja Morant has an electric energy about him. Like, no one does the stuff that he does around the rim. Nobody does. But as we saw with Derrick Rose, Russell Westbrook also had to change his game. John Wall also had to change his game, and it didn't have that kind of prime years that we expected from young John Wall. Is that when you're a guy that size, that his entire game is predicated on getting into the paint and finishing amongst the trees, and you're not able to do that at a high level, you better be just this like surgical passing guy who is able to defend at a high level. Drew Holiday, Tony Parker, they've been point guards that kind of evolved into championship level point guards as like the third wheel. I don't see it for Ja. Like, I think it's going to take a lot of evolution from Ja Morant, defensive, shooting wise, into becoming one of those like high level contributors on a championship team. Because as is, I just don't see him as the number one guy or the number two guy on a championship team. And that jump shot just has to get better. It looked great against the Golden State Warriors. And we've got lots to get into more on Ja Morant. After the break, we're going to get into your four little numbers, Dan, right after the break. All right, Dan, four little numbers about Ja Morant and the Memphis Grizzlies. By the way, in the end of the show, we're going to talk about this this great matchup, this showcase. Warriors, Lakers, first time Jimmy and the Jimmy Warriors have faced against the Luka Lakers. This is going to be awesome. I hope everyone's going to be playing on Thursday night. We're going to get into that later. But first, your four little numbers. What's your first one?
First little number this week is 11.3. That's how many possessions per game Ja Morant is finishing as the ball handler in the pick and roll this season, according to Synergy Sports. That figure, 11.3, includes all the times when he shoots after taking a ball screen from a teammate and all the times when he comes off the pick and passes to somebody who shoots. So both ends of it, not just his own shot, but playmaking as well. 11.3 per game is 34th in the NBA this season. It's between Jordan Poole and Keontae George. That's not where you'd expect to see Ja Morant, considering every year of his career up before this, it's in the top 10, 9th, 6th, 6th, 7th, 9th, and more often up like 19, 20 per game. So that's been cut nearly in half how frequently he is finishing plays as the ball handler in the pick and roll. We mentioned earlier, kind of a function of the design and the redesign of that Memphis offense, increased democratization, a little bit away from pick and roll to move, space, drive, cut, relocate, the kind of whirling dervish wheel motion that they were using earlier in the season. But that, as we mentioned, leads to some of the decline in those individual numbers for Ja, which again, reportedly didn't sit well with him. And then he voiced his frustrations publicly and privately. So it's worth noting that the pick and roll numbers have begun to increase. I think you've got some notes on that, but like, was an experiment that tried to run the offense without being all about Ja just kind of doomed to fail from the start?
Like, why were they doing that? Like, that's my thing, is you got Ja Morant and it's like, let's take the ball out of his hands and he's probably not going to be happy about it. It seems like a pretext to maybe trade him later. Like, why would you want to like antagonize or at least go against the grain with your superstar? That's my first question. My second question is, you know, in McMahon's reporting and Mike Wright's reporting, Ramona's reporting, that they were offering seven-figure salaries to two assistants, one of which was in the second row. That's a huge commitment to kind of like conflicting offensive philosophies, so conflicting that they got rid of one of them along with Taylor Jenkins 9 games before the postseason. And now you're seeing, okay, Isolo is going to take over the reins and we're going to see more pick and roll actions. And by the way, I covered this on TomTheFinder.com earlier this week. Memphis had 3 straight games, Dan. 3 straight games without scoring in the pick and roll as the ball handler. Dan, 3 games in a row where Desmond Bane, not Desmond Mason, I'm talking Desmond Bane, Scottie Pippen Jr., not Scottie Pippen Sr., even though he's not senior because they spell it differently, which is weird. Whatever. Thing. Or John Morant, zero pick and roll points for those ball handlers in three straight games. We rarely see this for one game across the NBA, and they had it for three straight games. And you know how many points they scored in the pick and roll against the Golden State Warriors on Tuesday night? 33. 33 games under
East,
33 points under Isolo, which is a lot more. It's a season high for the Grizzlies. So it's very clear, right? The change of direction, what it's all about. But again, how good is Ja Morant in the pick and roll in the first place? And why are we drafting Zach Edey, not using the pick and roll, starting him, not starting him? It just seems like a lot of conflicting opinions in the front office and or on the floor with the coaching staff and or Ja Morant and the rest of the team. So hopefully we get some kind of focus of where this is all going. But pick and roll stats have not been pretty for Ja Morant, and now they're emphasizing it more. But it might be just to like pay lip service to Ja Morant and hopefully keep him happy, or the opposite. It's a way to say, this isn't working. We got to figure something out.
Well, that's, and before we get onto the second little number, just very quickly, the reason I think they felt like they had to overhaul it is twofold. One, those Ja pick and rolls have not been particularly efficient plays. You mentioned that the numbers aren't great. This season, just under 1 point per possession on all those pick and rolls, whether it's him shooting or him passing to somebody who shoots. Among 182 players who've run 100 of them, that's 81st, mid. Last year, 106th out of 185. Year before that, 59 out of 183. Year before that, 92 out of 192. Like, we are consistently seeing, yes, while heavy pick and roll volume might be better for Ja, it might not necessarily be better for a Grizzlies offense that over the last handful of seasons has been in the half court, 29th in half court scoring efficiency, 22nd, 22nd, 26th. So we've lionized the Grizzlies' ability to make hash out of like offensive rebounding, transition, we create turnovers, we push. But when the game slows down and you got to unlock things to get to the paint to create great shots, they've struggled at it. So they try something different. It works for a while. People start to bristle at it. Now we got a whole different thing. So yes, you're right. It feels like there's some conflicting interests here. And, I don't know, Taylor Jenkins' interests are no longer particularly relevant to the Memphis Grizzlies at this point. Let's move away from there. So our second little number of this week, 53.3. That is the percentage of Memphis's regular season games in which Ja Morant has appeared since the beginning of the 2021-22 season. By my math, that's a little more than half, which is not what you're looking for when you're paying a little more than $40 million a year. In fairness, that share is skewed because he only played 9 or 10 games last season, the beginning part losing the 25 games to suspension. And then after that, you know, season ending shoulder injury. But even so, even like the mostly healthy seasons, missed 30% of the year, 2021-22, 28% in 22-23, nearly 40% this year. And so like some of the absences, it's hard to ding them for. Some of them, it's really not hard to ding them for at all. And it's a problem we've seen teams like the Clippers with Kawhi and Paul George, or the Sixers with Joel Embiid and Paul George have to deal with. Like, if your signature marquee build it all around me star isn't there, how do you really keep building it around him?
And that's the thing, man. It's the inconsistency. It's the unreliability. It's the fact that you nailed it. He's played in basically half the games in recent years. And then you throw in the fact that he hasn't played 10 consecutive games for the Grizzlies since a stretch that began in 2022. I'm going to say that again. Ja Morant hasn't played 10 games in a row since 2022. It's 2025 now, Dan. Like, the fact that they haven't been able to get him in uniform, and yes, there are new healthy scratch and resting strategies across the NBA, and back-to-backs are being, you know, leveled off for a lot of players of that star caliber, but a lot of it is just, he's injured. He's banged up. And if you're Ja Morant, who earlier this season was like, yeah, I'm not dunking anymore, and then he's going to be dunking again, and now he's like, yeah, kind of in the middle. This is a big question, is can Ja Morant play with that kind of force and that velocity that we've come to love about him? Or is it coming at a cost that like that game, that bumper car rise above just the thing that we love about Ja Morant is also the thing that we're scared of with Ja Morant, is that every time he leaves the floor, we get a little nervous that he's going to land awkwardly, or he's going to be bumped off his trajectory or something like that. And it's just kind of scary. And it's a lot safer to be a good perimeter threat in the NBA because it's just not as much velocity and not enough, as much violence and collisions. And so the question for me is, like, are we at a point where we are not entering the Kawhi Leonard zone, but we just can't guarantee more than 50 games, 60 games for Ja Morant going forward? And this season, we've already lost 30 games from Ja Morant, and there wasn't a suspension yet. So that's the cornerstone. That's your cornerstone of the franchise. And it doesn't seem like they can rely on him playing every single night or even 70 games a night. So that's a big deal. That's a big deal when you're trying to sell another team potentially in a trade, is how many games can you get for Ja Morant? And I'm not so sure there are a lot of teams who are looking at that saying that's an extremely plus contract. So do you have another number, little number here?
Yeah, I want to pivot to a different cornerstone of the Grizzlies' sort of organizational hierarchy there. Third little number this week is 116.5. That's the Grizzlies' defensive rating since January 1st, yes, according to NBA Advanced Stats. What have the Memphis Grizzlies always been built on? That defense, that grit, that grind. Shouts out to Tony Allen, first team.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't been seeing a whole hell of a lot of that in Memphis over the last 3 months. 116.5 defensive rating is 22nd in the NBA since January 1st, right in between the Hawks and Kings. And, you know, shouts out to Dyson Daniel and Keegan Murray, but that's not where you want to be in terms of the overall defensive rating. And before that, the first month, you know, couple months of the season, 108.3 defensive rating, fourth in the NBA. So they've fallen from a top five defense to a bottom third defense. And in a related story, they've been playing 500 ball for 3 months, tied for the ninth best record in the West. So I think that is maybe the under-discussed aspect of the Taylor Jenkins firing, of the Memphis story overall. Even when things have been up and down, or even when they were injured last season, that team has been good to great on defense, even going back before Taylor Jenkins was there to J.B. Bickerstaff, and then obviously further back to Mike Conley days and the Marc Gasol days. But they've been like a bottom third of the league defense for more than half the season. And wondering, like, what do you think has contributed to some of that defensive backslide?
Well, I think a lot of defense is communication and being together and chemistry. And that starts with the coach, starts with the organization, everyone being on the same page. And if you're not lockstep, it's going to show on the defensive end. And secondly, Dan, with a team like Memphis that likes to get out in transition, they're one of the highest volume transition team in the NBA, getting 25% of their offense in transition, according to Synergy. That is predicated on getting turnovers. That is predicated on getting stops. And if you're not doing that, you're going to look mid. The Memphis Grizzlies are going to look like just another team if they can't get out in transition and have to play in the half court all the time. And this is the thing. If you keep giving up 125, they've in the last 10 games, Dan, they've given up six times at 125 or more. Six times in the last 10 games. That is unacceptable for a team trying to win a championship, especially when every time that you give up a basket, that's way less of a chance you're going to get Ja Morant going downhill. Because if you have to take the ball out of the basket, you're going against a set defense. And that's so much harder. And as you saw down the stretch, Ja Morant going through a thicket of trees, trying to score in the paint when his legs are tired, that is a lot harder proposition in the fourth quarter than it is in the first quarter. And that, unfortunately, I think is a big contributor to why you're seeing that offense not be as high as it used to be or humming in open court situations. It's because they're tired and their defense just isn't up to snuff. And that's the biggest problem, Dan, that we like to talk about Ja and the offense, and we're all guilty of it. But if they don't have that grit and grind mentality defensively, then there is no playoff hopes for the Memphis Grizzlies. They have to have both. They can't have one without the other.
You saw it against the Warriors, right? 45 points in the first quarter. That's the sixth time this season they've given up a 45-point quarter, which is nuts. Five of those have come since January 1. They're now, bottom four, bottom five in first quarter defensive rating in that span. 70 points before halftime. Like, it's again and again. And it's like, you're right. Getting beat by back cuts, losing Steph on relocation threes, the specific of like Zach Edey not being up close enough to contest on the ball screen, like giving Steph open looks around as he curls around the screen, because if he doesn't drop back, then what's he going to do when somebody drives past him? And then like that goes to why are you not using Zach Edey more and getting him in the pick and roll? Well, because you're maybe a little bit worried about what he's given up on the back end. And Brandon Clark not being there because he's out for the season with an injury is a huge problem for them. He was a real, like, you know, important glue piece for their front court mixes, him and Jaren Jackson Jr., him and Santi Aldama, him and Edey. Like, he made a lot of partnerships work. It just, it seems like we've had moments where, you know, Steven Adams gets hurt, Brandon Clark gets hurt, guys go in and out and things sort of start to fall apart. It feels like that's happening now with Memphis. And when it happens on the defensive end, everything else starts to go haywire. And it brings me to my fourth little number, 61. That is, as of the day of this podcast released, that's how many days it has been since the last time the Memphis Grizzlies beat a top six seed from either conference. Two full months. February 2nd against the Milwaukee Bucks. So not even the higher of the top six seeds, the sixth seed, but February 2nd.
That could have been the big number, Dan. 61 days.
It's not a bad one.
Since they played a locked-in playoff opponent and won. Yeah.
Since they beat, here are the wins since February 2nd. San Antonio, Toronto, Phoenix, Orlando, Dallas, New Orleans, Utah, Miami. Not a whole lot of postseason aspirants there in that group. All, for the full season, above 500 teams, Memphis is 11-23. That's one of the worst of any of the postseason aspirant teams. Like they you ratchet it down to top 10 point differentials, 6-19 against the Thunder, Cavs, Celtics, that, you know, group of teams. And given that, given the defensive issues we've talked about, given the struggles against top-end teams, maybe we should have seen this coming. You know, like it's difficult to say given Taylor Jenkins's overall success, given the fundamentals of, like, they were 44-29 or the top 6 point differential, whatever. But given, like, the under the hood stuff, and then what we're now seeing in the reporting, the burbling frustrations of Ja, like, maybe the writing has been on the wall here for a while.
Yeah. But then why didn't you let him go at the All-Star break when these things were bubbling up and give Isolo an opportunity to install an offense over the break? It just seems like, I don't know, the plan, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. And the Memphis Grizzlies got punched in the face. Thanks, Mike Tyson. They got punched in the face and they're still bleeding everywhere and trying to figure out a way to get out of this. And look, The Grizzlies, I thought, were a feel-good story for the first couple months of the season. The way that they got out, I thought Taylor Jenkins had weathered the storm of the offseason, of his whole coaching staff being overhauled, coming in, and they looked great. At the time, last week, they had a top six net rating, and they're not too far away from that. It just feels like Ja Morant needs to go on this like epic run here down the stretch to not just save this season, but also to give us an idea of the Isolo, the head coach from Finland, who was at Paris basketball last year under David Kahn. For OG NBA fans, you know that name. David Kahn from the Minnesota Timberwolves is running Paris basketball. And so it just seems like we're going to learn a lot about this team over the next couple weeks. And maybe Ja Morant can kind of continue what he did against the Golden State Warriors, hitting that deep ball, that three ball. If he can do that, that unlocks so much for them. Because a lot of times they were just going under those screens and kind of daring Ja Morant to shoot. And he was hitting them for the most part, but kind of fell apart down the stretch. So the defense, his injuries, the ability to play up to their opponents and figure out the pick and roll. Amazing job by you, Dan. Those are some great little numbers. After the break, we're going to talk about this showdown between the Warriors and the Lakers, something we might get in the 4-5, which would be crazy, right after the break. All right, Dan, I got a stat for you. Steph Curry.
That's cool. We do that stat. We do stats on this show, so that's awesome. Hit me with it.
Yeah, I got a stat here. All right, 52 points. 12 threes, 10 rebounds, 8 assists, 5 steals on Tuesday. That is the best game score. Now, game score is like a PER metric, an all-in-one productivity metric for one-game sample sizes, basically taking your box score and putting it into, like, how good was your game. The game score for Stephen Curry on Tuesday night against the Memphis Grizzlies in regulation was 48.6. That is the best game score in NBA history for a 37-year-old. That is the best game score in NBA history for a 36-year-old. That is the best game score in NBA history for a 35-year-old and a 34-year-old. Dan, this was an insane game by just about any standard, and he just turned 37. Steph Curry is insane, man. He's insane. And look, like, we've got two guys, Steph Curry and LeBron James, who are doing things that we have never seen at this age. They look like they're still in their primes, and we're going to get them going at it on Thursday night. Hopefully we get all the players playing. We don't get this often in the NBA, but the Lakers had a couple of days off before this one, so hopefully we get Luka, LeBron, and Austin Reeves playing. And on the other side, Draymond, Steph, and Jimmy Butler. This is a 4-5 seed matchup as currently constituted in the standings. I don't know if I want this in the first round. It seems unfair to be in the first round. But Dan, what are you most looking forward to in this potential first round matchup that I could also see as being like honestly, if we did a 1-16 gauntlet, get rid of conferences, like there are alternate universes where you could say that the Lakers and the Warriors might play each other in the NBA finals. That's how good these two teams are.
Yeah, I mean, it made me think of the old joke that like David Stern's dream NBA matchup, playoff matchup was Lakers versus Lakers, but Lakers versus this Warriors team might
not
be far off.
Did you say it was
off.
A joke, or did you say it was a true statement by David Stern?
Yeah, right. Oh, I'll say I know that it was an apocryphal statement. I don't know the specific story, but I know if it's you hear it a lot. And I would imagine this would be right up his alley too. But he might say, no, we got to hold that off for a few rounds. Come on, we can't do that at the beginning of April. There's so much to love about this. I think there's the fact that you're seeing these teams like at their, like reaching their apex at the right time. Like the Warriors have been, I think they're 19-5 since they traded for Jimmy.
18-2 with those three, the big three, 18-2
with
Draymond, Jimmy Butler, and Stephen Curry on the floor, 18-2.
Like, and it really does feel like he's unlocked both of them, right? Like the Draymond Green, you know, self-propelled defensive player of the year push started after Jimmy shows up. And now there's two of those guys who are like 6'7", just havoc wreakers on the back end. And I think they're fourth in defensive efficiency since Jimmy got there too. And then Steph like goes on the heater that he's been on for the last 2 months when Jimmy shows up to kind of take some of the pressure off, give another playmaker, another guy who can be a screening partner, another guy who can direct traffic, draw attention, give Steph a little bit more breathing room. Like it's all clicking, and you're getting the, you know, the contributions from the younger guys, from Quentin Post, from Gui Santos, like the roster's really coming together. So to get to see, to test that, the one like sling or arrow that you can throw against this Warriors run is like, it's been against a pretty soft run of schedule for the most part. They haven't seen a ton of great teams. All right, let's see how it goes against Luka and LeBron, Austin Reeves, this Lakers team, where now their record overall since they got Luka, I think it's only like 15-10, 14-8 with Luka in the lineup. But they're like +8 per 100 with Luka on the floor. Since those first couple of games where he was getting the rust off after the long injury layoff in the trade, he's right up there again at like 38-8 on like 600 true shooting. Like you're seeing the best versions of these guys as they're coalescing and the teams are learning each other. Man, when everything goes small and they're playing small, which the Lakers were awesome the other night against Houston when they did that, and Dorian Finney-Smith at the five, and they have like five like-sized dudes who can all shoot and all put the ball on the floor and all move it. Like there's just Rui Hachimura is part of that mix. And like, there's a lot to like. We haven't even really talked about LeBron James, who also, by the way, is like, because he's expending less energy running everything on offense, he's blocking shots above the rim to save games. And there's a lot to love about this matchup. So yeah, I mean, it's the line from Almost Famous, right? Like, what do I love about it? To begin with, everything. I can't wait to see how every part of it, but Tom, it's maybe too many things. What about you? What are you excited to watch in it?
How good is Austin Reeves, man? I mean, he's a baller. He's a hooper, dude. He's 25.7 points per game in his last 10 games, 6 assists, 5 rebounds. He's shooting 67% on twos over that stretch, man. 35% on threes, which translates to he's shooting 52% from the floor, 35% from three, and 96% at the line. A little bit foul merchant, little bit in Austin Reeves' game. Like, we've always known that about him, but you can't deny that he's a baller. So like, if the Lakers get this dude who's averaging like 25 a game with Luka Doncic, basically, That's a game changer. And like, I'm going to say here, there's three guys that I'm looking at for first time All-Stars next year. Austin Reaves, Chet Holmgren, and Denny Abdia. Those three dudes are going to be first time All-Stars next year because the way that they're playing, and Chet Holmgren, I think because of the injury this year, I don't think people realize how good he is. And I think the Oklahoma City Thunder deserve three All-Stars, not just Jalen and SGA, but like those three guys, the way that they're playing this year, I just love their games. Denny Abdia, he just had another game where he was 32 points, 15 rebounds, 10 assists, triple-double. First time in Blazers history that a guy has had 30-plus, 15-plus, and 10-plus in a game.
Wow.
Just nuts. Denny Abdia. So he's been on fire. I think he's second in AM1s since the February 1st behind Paolo Banchero. Just a bully. He's a straight-up bully. And Austin Reaves, the way he's playing, Chet Holmgren, those three dudes, man, they're playing at a high level, and I hope to see it translate next year too. But Austin Reaves, I want to see what he can do against Jimmy Butler and against Draymond. Like those are guys that like in the trenches. Yeah,
that's one thing. Okay, one specific aesthetic thing I'm looking forward to. I really love that both Draymond and LeBron are letting their beards go gray. I forget if we've talked about this before. We maybe haven't, but it underlines how impressive everything that they're doing is. And as somebody whose beard is going gray bit by bit and who's getting roasted about that by my children, I appreciate seeing, you know, being able to see representation on the screen is really important. And seeing those guys operating at such a high level at the most important time of the season while the grays continue to mount up in their beard, it brings some joy to my heart.
Dan, I'm so glad you brought this up. I feel like it's one of LeBron's greatest missteps is not going full Kyrie Irving, Uncle Drew, growing out the beard, a gray beard, and dominating these kids. Like, I feel like it would add so much to his legacy. He's always trying to find, like, what is going to differentiate myself between Michael. I can't beat Michael. I can't beat 6-0, but I can move from team to team and win championships. I can't, you know, start a shoe line business or the Jordan brand. But what I can do is like start a movie, you know, production studio in LA and become a star in Hollywood. Like, I'm just a kid from Akron. All this stuff that he's trying to kind of not do the same thing that Michael did and start his own thing. If he just did the gray beard, got rid of the Just for Men, ditched that, and said, I'm going full gray beard on this entire league, I feel like people would then realize how insane it is that he's playing at this level at 40 years old. Like, I think it'd be great if he just went full Uncle Drew and embraced the gray. Dan, right? Like, for all the dads out there.
Absolutely. But what I will say to that is, let's check back in 5 years when he's in his like end of his Knicks Jason Kidd era, just sort of like barely moving around the perimeter, but still averaging 7 assists a game. I think that's because at this point, I have no idea when it ends. So that is on the table for me. You know, we'll check back. It'll be a couple of elections or whatever. But if we still have elections, but you know, by then, and we'll see where we are. But I think full gray LeBron is on the table. Old man Logan, I think it's all there for us for the taking.
All right, I will put it on the ballot, my own personal ballot. That
yes,
I am going to vote yes to LeBron's beard.
We have the facts, and we're voting yes on gray beard LeBron.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Dan, awesome big number this week. Thanks so much for doing this. As we do every Thursday, go subscribe, rate, review, tell your buddies, everybody. Appreciate you. That's going to do it for us today. Thanks to Emmy, Mike Stone, and the entire squad behind the scenes making this podcast a reality. Remember, we're on YouTube. Go subscribe there or wherever you get your podcast. Leave us a rating review. Again, please be back next week with another episode of The Big Number. Until then, please be safe and enjoy the opening days of baseball and all this football stuff out there and more controversy when LeBron James and Steph Curry go head to head. I'm sure there's going to be something in that game. Grow out the beard. Grow out the gray beard. Please, LeBron. All right. Until next time.